Hello and welcome to the March 28th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'm Anthony Bardaway and I'll be hosting this one solo. This week's episode will focus on two major themes, the first of which will be the very large Russian missile barrage that is currently ongoing pretty much every single night. And then we'll be getting into the mass shooting in Moscow by the Islamic State, with some other topics added in, but those are the two main ones I'll be discussing. But first, I'll be talking about some updates that you may be interested in. Some of you may know that I also do contract work for the Kyiv Independent, and the latest Kyiv Independent documentary is out, titled In Whole or In Part, which explores the concept of the legal definition of genocide, and if Russia is indeed committing genocide in Ukraine. You may remember that we did an interview almost two years ago now, pretty early in the war, regarding this very topic, and have discussed it throughout. Largely, this other Kyiv Independent topics that I have voiced documentaries for have included the kidnapping of children, which is the largest part of the genocide, because one of the definitions of genocide is, you know, taking kids away from one group and transferring them to another. So go there. It's on YouTube. I'll put a link in the description. And because this one doesn't neatly fit into a narrative flow, I'll start out with a conference that I went to last week, the Kyiv Security Forum. The Kyiv Security Forum is an annual conference that brings together the leaders of Ukraine's partner countries to discuss mostly military topics. Before the full-scale invasion, these conferences tended to be much larger. That's one thing that I noticed this time around. I have not been to any big conferences since the time of the full-scale invasion. Not a particular reason not to. They have had them. But there was one thing I noted is that before they were in rather large ballrooms that required a lot of, you know, seating and catering and all that. And this time around, the conference was in an already smaller location, and from there, about half empty. I don't want to use that as, you know, a statement against the conference, but there are less people. But I don't know what it means to have such a reduced number there. I don't have a lot of takeaways from this forum, except to say that it deals a lot with my, you know, New Year prediction that Ukraine's international outlook is much more in the European Union rather than the United States at the moment, until all that can be resolved. And so a lot of the topics there were about European strategic integration, about what the Europeans can do for Ukraine, what Ukraine can do for Europeans. I think I can go over some of the topics, the headliners here. So it starts off with just kind of some look backs at Ukraine's path towards European integration, the path of revolution of dignity and historic choice, Ukraine's ascension to the EU and NATO, democratic choice, protection of the fundamental freedoms, terra causa coram, what do we stand for, which was kind of about the Baltic to Black Sea region and its security integration. The future of Europe, political vision, Russia's crimes, no escape from justice, which was about war crimes prosecutions against the Russian military, a united forces defense dimension, which was about how to respond to further Russian incursions into Europe. The next day, going into what steps Ukraine might take in the future towards joining NATO. There have been many steps thus far. It's in the candidate status, so if this year there would be any further advances in that direction. Some stuff about the current situation at the front, the prospects of negotiation, and the prospects of a third world war. It was pretty interesting, but there's one weakness with these things, is that most of the people there are European elected officials. Just in my time as a journalist, the two people who are restricted the most in what they can say are diplomats and European parliamentarians. They're very careful with how they use words. Everyone is in agreement with the need to support Ukraine, but they do not have the authority to make promises on their own, so there's only so far they can go with that. One statement that did stick out to me was that a Spanish parliamentarian mentioned that Ukraine was the military of Europe and Europe needs to defend, you know, the army that's protecting it from Russia, which is interesting because tends to be that the further away you get from Russia, the more apathetic the politicians tend to be. And Spain, other than Portugal, of course, is as far away from Ukraine as you can get in the European Union. So he recognized the importance of continental defense. But yeah, everyone's real guarded in their talk. So what you heard from there is basically what we've already said here. You know, need to get Ukraine more weapons, which I haven't put this in my notes, but the Czechs with their initiative to get Ukraine artillery shells doubled the amount they plan to deliver to Ukraine. So that is as vital as it gets. But, you know, also you have to keep in mind that the people who will show up to Kyiv for a security forum will already be the politicians that are predisposed to supporting Ukraine. So they're going to be the ones saying, here's the information I'll be bringing back to my colleagues in my government to ask them to support these policies, rather than them saying, these are the policies we will do. It's kind of a team effort in that way. So I don't know. I still enjoy going to a conference. I wish I would have spent a bit more time there for interviews and such, but that wasn't fully an option for me, unfortunately. But we'll see where we can go with that. We'll be definitely keeping our eye on the European integration topic. Like I said, it is the most important topic as far as international goes. So from there, we'll go into our combat update now. Russia does continue to advance, although their advance has slowed down since our last combat update 3 weeks ago. So 2 weeks ago, we did an interview so we didn't have other news. So it would be 3 weeks ago was the last time we had a combat update. And the front line is still more or less where it was then. The description I gave then more or less still holds. There are these towns outside of Avdiivka that Russia is advancing through, though at the other end of those towns, on the other side of them, I should say, there are a few rivers, reservoirs, ponds, natural barriers, about as much of a barrier as you can get in the southern steppe that Russia has kind of run into. Whereas in my previous update, I said that they're still a small distance away from running into. So in the meta sense of the word, they have not really changed their positioning there, though two more villages have fallen in the Avdiivka area. Looking slightly northward to Bakhmut, the Russians have also extended their control out of Bakhmut and have taken more of the area of Ivanovska. And the reason for this is, again, the shortage of artillery shells to repel the Russian advance, while Russia is taking advantage of its opportunity to push as hard as it can right now. Though there is word of them building up a larger offensive force, most likely in Kupiansk, but I've said that exact bit of news probably about four times in the last year of Russians building up to attack Kupiansk. So who's to say if this time is any different? Although one factor that has been much of a problem recently is increased Russian uses of glide bombs. These are bombs dropped from airplanes and, as the name implies, are able to glide to their target. So they're able to have the yield of a larger bomb, you know, drop from a plane while having a bit of the range they can get from a missile, but without it having to actually be a missile. These glide bombs have also been increasingly used against Ukrainian cities, especially Kharkiv has been taking a lot of glide bombs recently. But we'll get it more into the attacks against Ukrainian cities in a bit here. Meanwhile, there was a large series of attacks against Russian oil refineries. These refineries can be as much as, you know, hundreds of kilometers within Russian borders. So the attacks are pretty far reaching. These attacks blowing up or heavily damaging Russian oil refineries using long-range suicide drones have reportedly affected 12% of Russia's refinery capabilities. So they've hardly taken out their refinery capacity, but as a pretty large dent. 12% is a pretty big number, and which has resorted to Russia having to import some of its gasoline from Belarus. And the last of my combat updates here is that, once again, the various recruits from the Russian Federation, the various units that are loyal to the Ukrainian military, but made up of people from the Russian Federation. So we're talking the Russian Volunteer Corps, the Free Russia Legion, now the Siberian Corps, which we'll actually talk about next episode. I was going to talk more about foreign fighters this episode until events occurred. So until then, I'll put some of the more detail on the back burner here, as well as several Chechen units have been taking part in various raids along the Ukrainian-Russian border. They have captured several villages within the Belgorod Oblast, especially, as well as the Kursk Oblast. And while previous raids have lasted only, maybe 2 days at most, this one still seems to be going. There's not much information about them, but there still seems to be fighting within Russia, with the Russians either being unwilling or unable to fully expel these raids. This has been presented as, a civil war, and even Ukraine has been presenting this as Russians coming to free their people and overthrow their government and a civil war and all that, which, I mean, that's mostly trolling. I don't think anyone is under any delusion that these Russian units are operating independently of the Ukrainian government, or specifically Ukrainian military intelligence. So to say that they are some internal force within Russia is a mistake, though larger elements of the Russian opposition have thrown their support behind these more militant units as opposed to the peaceful opposition, including some pretty important people who have a history of, environmental protests and such, saying that this is, unfortunately for them, the only way forward for a free Russia is through military means. Though some of the units involved are not exactly liberal, this is what it is. It's a raid by the Ukrainian military using Russian citizens against the Russian regime. This brings me to the most important topic in Ukraine at the moment, which is that Russia has once again really stepped up its use of missile strikes against Ukrainian cities. These things tend to come in waves. Russia will build up its capacity for missile strikes over a certain period of time until having enough to launch them in large volume. Just hitting Kyiv with one missile every 2 weeks isn't exactly threatening, but having it be a nightly series of alarms is more likely to kind of disrupt people's lives and make things much more unpleasant. So that's why they tended to go in spurts in the past. And the largest such attack was on the 22nd. This was very big. I think it might have been the largest overall missile strike of the war, and perhaps the most destructive in terms of results. The strikes on the 22nd, and really since the 22nd, because everything I'm saying here has been an ongoing problem since then, have been mostly targeted towards electricity, power plants, infrastructure for energy. It's actually kind of unusual, I think, that they're doing that now. Last winter, these strikes against energy infrastructure were used throughout the winter, the previous winter, when that was really the most uncomfortable point for them to happen. It's cold, and without these geothermal plants, there's no heating. It got a bit chilly, even in my apartment, which is pretty modern. But now they've had these strikes after the winter's over, and though the energy issue has caused the heating season to come to premature close, in Ukraine, how it works is there is a kind of centralized heating, and the decision is made by the city to turn it off or on. And in several cities, especially Kharkiv, they made the choice to, winter's over now, we're turning off the heat, we don't have the energy to keep that going, even when we do have electricity. So the timing of it is strange that they would do that as things are warming up, but there's theories. I think it has to do with the degradation of Ukrainian air defense. But the largest hit on the 22nd was 15 missiles were used against the TETS-5 heat and power plant in Kharkiv, or rather just outside of Kharkiv. What made this attack unusual is that usually there will be maybe one or a handful of missiles used against a single target. This time they used, like I said, 15 against a single target, which made any defense impossible. In Kharkiv, air defense is already quite difficult because of their closeness to the Russian border and therefore closeness to wherever the launches will be coming from. There's only so much time that you can have to mobilize a defense. But any kind of air defense that could have been there was completely overwhelmed by the mass used against a single target. And while often these attacks on power plants are able to be repaired, it seems as though the damage to this plant was so extensive, it would take a minimum of 1 year to repair. So it might not even be available for next winter. Kharkiv continues to face power shortages since then. The city does not have full electricity. Right after this strike, most of the city had lost both power and heating, and well, hot and warm water along with it. And it's still going. It has been repaired to a certain extent. Electricity has been imported from other regions of Ukraine into Kharkiv to take up some of the slack, but that's still not enough, and there's still blackouts in the city. The other one, which is to me more worrying on a larger scale, is in Zaporizhia. There was a missile strike on the dam in Zaporizhia. On this show, we've talked a lot about the disaster at the Khokhovka dam just north of Kherson, about the flooding of that caused and the after effects of the people living next to the reservoir. We've talked about it quite a bit. If you've listened to this podcast, you've heard a lot about the Khokhovka reservoir and the cascade of dams that go up and down the Dnipro River. And Zaporizhia is the next dam up. So what was the start of the Khokhovka reservoir is the Dnipro dam in Zaporizhia. And the Russians hit that with a missile strike as well. This did damage the energy production in Zaporizhia because it did hit the energy stations within the dam. It's a hydroelectric dam. This dam is also the main bridge that connects the eastern and western parts of Zaporizhia on either side of the Dnipro River. And there was a Mashrutka, a minibus, that was passing by when this missile strike occurred, and deaths happened in that Mashrutka. Now, it's hard to blow up a dam from the outside, so the damage to any structural integrity of the dam was pretty minimal, though if that dam is damaged, that would be a very, very bad thing. The city of Zaporizhia would be flooded. We're talking about large-scale humanitarian disaster, in addition to any flooding that would occur in Kherson because of it hitting an already flood-affected area. But like I said, that is not enough. One missile is not enough to bring down a dam. Dams are sturdy. They are built for World War III. That's what they're kind of there for, was the Soviet Union built these things to withstand that kind of damage, which is also why we know that the Khokhovka Dam must have been blown up from the inside by Russians. So shutting down that conspiracy theory. The other problem from the loss of electricity to Zaporizhia and the loss of life from the hit on who was there at the time is that the Dnipro Dam is also the supply of electricity to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is under Russian occupation only a short distance downstream. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is not currently functioning as a nuclear power plant, but it still requires electricity to keep its safety systems up and going. The safety systems and electricity supply has been under threat a number of times, but they rely on electricity from Zaporizhia to work at all. So there was a period of time where these safety systems did not have the power to keep going. And although it was soon restored, that's scary. You really have to look out for the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Something can always go bad there. Also on the 22nd, they hit pretty much every major city in Ukraine, including as far away as Khmelnytsky. Two people were killed in Khmelnytsky. Odessa And it's worth noting that earlier on the 15th, there was an attack on Odessa that was a double tap attack, meaning that where the Russians attacked one building, and then when the first responders showed up to save anyone, there was another missile strike at the exact same location. 16 people were killed and 70 were injured in that attack, but Odessa was also injured, was also struck on the 22nd as well. Sumy is being struck all the time, and I think that is one news story that I need to do follow up on, is that in the Sumy region, they are being hit every single day. And like I said, these strikes keep on coming. Kharkiv is being bombarded. Sumy is being bombarded. Odessa being struck fairly frequently. If past trends continue to hold, there will only be a certain amount of time that Russia can keep up this kind of tempo. They only produce missiles at a certain rate, and that rate cannot dip below how much they are using, or they'll run out of missiles. So who knows how long this will go, though, like I said previously, this has been added to the problem of aerial glide bombs, of Russian aircraft being used to drop bombs and have them glide a significant distance, which has been heavily affecting both Kharkiv and Kherson especially. Though there is one missile strike that I went to, it's not affected by it when the strike happened. Actually fairly close, but on the other side of the river from me, on the 25th, there was a missile strike on the Boychuk Academy of Decorative and Applied Arts. This is a pretty prestigious arts institution in Kyiv. I was hearing from a lot of art students sharing their experiences at the school afterwards, and how, you know, this institution that means so much to them was partially destroyed by the Russians and the Russian war on artists. I will say that though the Russian war on art and artists is a important part of this story, the Ukrainian government seems to think that the intended target was actually the headquarters of the Ukrainian version of the FBI, which is the SBU. So this missile was headed towards the SBU headquarters, was shot down by air defense, and the debris crashed into this arts college. There were no deaths from this, thankfully. There were 7 people who were injured. 2 of them had to go to the hospital. The part of this building that was struck was the gymnasium, which was apparently not so much in use at the time, which is why, even though it happened in the morning on a weekday, there are not so many people there. And I decided to go to the site of this missile strike. When I got there, they were already cleaning up the debris. They had heavy equipment there, scooping the parts that had blown into the street for removal. People were going into the building to recover art and other things that they could get out to safety. There's some very famous photos, well, famous by now photos, of a young woman going into the rubble and taking out 2 or 3 paintings. I actually saw her as she was leaving, so I wasn't able to get that good photography shot myself, but she did not look so happy, we can say. You wouldn't be very happy either in that kind of scenario of having your college they have dedicated everything to be destroyed like that. Most of the rest of the building was largely okay, though the windows were mostly blown out and more blown out the closer you got to the destroyed wing. I was able to go into the building. I was able to go from kind of go into the classrooms, see what was going on there. I got some good photographs, which I'll share in the Patreon, though I also posted them on Twitter and my Instagram. I'll throw them on Patreon as well, I suppose. And now there's some poetry to it of statues and paintings and that are broken and torn apart by the Russian war machine. And it, you know, very, very literally destroying Ukrainian culture on top of the more meta sense of the word of them trying to destroy Ukrainian-ness as a concept. We had paintings and sculptures of Ukrainian culture literally destroyed. I was able to partially get into the destroyed section of the building, though obviously it was destroyed and lots of debris. And above the gymnasium, I was able to see it was basically like a storehouse. A lot of paintings and canvases were being kept there. And as much as you try to ignore nonsense Russian conspiracy theories, the official explanation for why this attack took place was the Russians saying that underneath this building was some kind of military intelligence command center. Well, I didn't see anything that indicated a military intelligence command center. I didn't see electronics or anything that looked at all military. All I saw was art. Though, to the Russians, I think the art might be more of a threat. They don't want Ukrainian culture to exist. That's what this is all about. But as I'm going through the building, there is another alarm. And I don't know about everyone else. Do as I say, not as I do. When there's an air raid alarm, I tend to ignore it entirely. But this time, all the first responders started, you know, sprinting past me. Got two firemen running out as fast as they could as I'm in one of the classrooms taking my little photos. And that's when I realized, if you see firemen running away from something, you should also run. And I did so. I got out of the building as quickly as I could, as they did as well. And that's when I realized that this is obviously the procedure that is taken to avoid double taps. Like I said, with Odessa, the Russian strategy of hitting the first responders who are there to save people in the aftermath of an attack being targeted themselves, that must be the standard operating procedure. I don't go to too many areas being struck recently by missiles very often. It's usually the same story. Building blown up, people died, take your pictures, move on. If there's a way to help, help, but usually not. But so this was something a bit new to me, seeing this procedure in place, and it makes complete sense. There weren't any more people trapped under the rubble, so they weren't vitally needed to save a life. They were that there. And if the Russians did a double tap, some of them would be killed just doing cleanup. Yeah, so long story short, I got out of there. And the last part that I have to say about this missile war is I'll talk about the Ukrainian response and what they are doing. So in addition to the strikes on these oil plants or oil refineries, there was also on the 23rd a large-scale attack using Storm Shadow missiles against the Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol. We covered this pretty often because Russian ships tend to be blown up pretty often. But in this case, this attack on the 23rd damaged two additional landing ships, as well as destroying a building used for communications infrastructure for the fleet. Quite frankly, I don't know why Russia continues to keep anything in Sevastopol, considering the pace of these attacks. The headquarters had been blown up, a lot of ships had been blown up in Sevastopol Harbor, and now two more, as well as a communications building. Holding on to Sevastopol at all is kind of suicidal, it seems, and doing it in any way, when the smart move is to just move everything to Novorossiysk or Rostov or somewhere else, deeper into, well, not just Russian-controlled territory, but Russian territory itself would be the smarter thing to do, but I guess they're still keeping a presence there. So yeah, the 23rd, another strike against the Black Sea Fleet, reducing it even further. So by the time that you listen to this episode, and I'm kind of making this episode unfortunately slowly, there'll probably be more missile strikes, there'll probably be more people who are killed by these missile strikes. There'll probably be more power outages, more tragic stories within the day or two it takes me to get this episode out. I'm not going to bother doing an update on that, if so, unless it is something particularly headline grabbing, but just assume that in the time it takes me to edit and release this episode, more tragedy has occurred in that way. And the reason for this is because of the degradation of Ukrainian air defense. There are fewer ways to defend Ukrainian cities as we lose our supply of air defense missiles and other weaponry. While the United States continues to sit on its hands and do nothing, while Europe tries to scramble to make up for the enormous gap left by an American presence, and as the Russians become emboldened to push their attacks even harder because of all those factors. So, moving on. Our next topic, this will be a real short one, is that the Russians held their presidential elections on March 15th through the 17th. And when I say elections, take that with the most stink eye one can summon up. There is no such thing as an election in Russia. It is an inauguration process. It is a power confirmation process, and the actual votes do not matter. The actual competition does not exist. There are a series of parties that exist solely to appear as an opposition and soak up any possible oppositionist feelings, either from the left or the right, but even that has been severely winnowed down. And surprise, surprise, Putin won. So another term for Vladimir Putin. This is not a real election. It's all rigged. It's not real. Though the one thing that is important to bring up is the expansion of the election process into Russia's occupied territories in Ukraine. Prior to the election, the process of forced passportization of Ukrainians was very stepped up, which is another topic that needs to be explored, of Ukrainians still living under occupation, rather not becoming Russian citizens, but having it forced upon them. Russian election officials went from house to house with under armed guard, had a guy with a gun following them around just in case there's any illusions as to what a vote was about. And this included into Avdiivka, some of the few survivors who were in Avdiivka right after the city was taken by the Russians. Now the Russians are going around threatening them to vote for the guy who just destroyed their home. Which takes us to our other headlining topic, which was the Crocus City Hall music venue attack in a suburb of Moscow. So the Crocus City Hall, it's a big concert hall in Krasnogorsk in Moscow Oblast to the northwest of Moscow City. And on March 22nd, there was a terror attack at a concert there. This is a big story with a lot of angles, and we benefit from being a niche news outlet from not having to cover every single one of them and able to give us more room to give commentary. But I will begin with some of the basic facts. So on March 22nd at 8 o'clock, four attackers opened fire in this concert hall, and by the time they were done, within about half an hour, I think it was, which is a long time, but we'll get to that, they were left with in excess of 140 people dead. And a similar number, last I saw, 182, injured. The attackers escaped and were later arrested. Allegedly, four people were arrested, I will choose to phrase that, in the Bryansk region to the west of Moscow later that day. We also know that the attack was claimed by the Islamic State Khorasan province, a spin-off of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria that operates largely out of Afghanistan and Central Asia. We also know that the four alleged attackers were Tajiks from Tajikistan. I think we'll just front-load this by saying that there is a lot fishy with the official story out of Russia. Namely, that two of the people that they named as captured suspects, the Tajik government then said, had no ability to actually be there at the time, and were in fact elsewhere. So the names that Russia gave were wrong, or at least the identities that Russia gave were wrong, at least initially. There's also one very weird bit of misinformation that came out of Russian information space that one of the people captured was Rustam Azayev, who is a Chechen commander within the Ukrainian military. However, the person that they showed as being Rustam looked absolutely nothing like him. Rustam is noticeably Chechen, not Tajik, and it seems as though that at the time he was leading part of the aforementioned raids into Russia in Belgorod region, not in Moscow. Or at least that's where it can be assumed he would be, because that's where his unit was. The Russian official story is also that the terrorists were on their way to escape into Ukraine, where there was, quote, a window was open for them to enter into Ukraine and to meet with their contacts here. Now, on a logical level, this makes no sense. They would be crossing over a front line of an active war zone, and a war zone that had already been flagged with Ukrainian border raids. So I would certainly assume that there was heightened Russian security presence along this border, and therefore not very easy to cross. And that is when Lukashenko, the dictator of Belarus, came in and ruined the narrative by saying that no, these guys are trying to come into Belarus, not Ukraine, but we in Belarus were smart enough to not let them through. That's why they turned south to try to get into Ukraine. So that already contradicts. This has been an ongoing issue with Lukashenko of him not sticking 100% to the Kremlin line when the Kremlin line might make him look not as good. And overall, the Russians have been blaming this as a Ukrainian operation, or variously, a Ukrainian, American, British, NATO operation with no real stance on who specifically was doing what. This narrative is, of course, utter nonsense. Even when Putin said that it was Ukraine who did it, he never actually explained how, what the evidence was, or even a general idea of what the evidence could have been. There was no narrative of how Ukrainians would have gone about this. There is only the statement that it could be only Ukraine that did this, which means he has no other narrative to back that up, and by not bringing a narrative up, he doesn't have to be checked on it. So everything Russia has said about this has been a lie. Some smaller lies, some bigger lies, which of course has kicked up a lot of conspiracy theorizing. And really, false flag attacks are not unusual for Russia. Putin came into power by basically bombing his own people in a series of apartment bombings, and then the last of these apartment bombings, there was FSB presence discovered there. They claimed that they're just doing a practice exercise, but no need to go into the 1999 bombings too far. But let's just say that this is very much within Putin's toolbox to utilize terror attacks to galvanize Russian opinion to do whatever he wants. However, what show are you listening to here? You're Ukraine Without Hype. We try to avoid conspiracy theorizing wherever possible, and I will now present what I actually believe, which is nothing to do with any conspiracy theories or subterfuge or anything like that. One, Putin does not need a terror attack to galvanize support. He can already do whatever he wants. They just had the election. Everyone kind of understood that the election could be used to say that the Russian people are fully behind the war, and they are, and therefore would support something like a full-scale mobilization. That could have happened with or without this. And so far, there has not been any real concrete steps that Russia has been taking in order to take advantage of any changes in public opinion, because public opinion does not matter in Russia. Everyone already supports the government already. No minor changes in overall opinion is going to do much. And even if they did change their opinion, it wouldn't matter anyway because it's a dictatorship. They do not have to do a 1999. It's no longer 1999. The Russian Putinist dictatorial state had not yet been solidified. A lot of time has passed since then. It's a different world. It's no longer needed. What I think happened was that, well, one more bit of information here is that this concert hall was pretty easy walk away from a National Guard base, apparently. From what you understand, one of the better aspects of the Razgardia, the National Guard / riot police / SWAT teams that could have responded. I have this theory that I bring up time and time again, that the reason for the explanation behind most things that happen in Russia is incompetence and corruption. There were police on scene. The police on scene did nothing. The response was incredibly slow. And that's because most of the security state resources in Russia are no longer in Russia. They are in Ukraine. The Razgardia was used as part of the spearhead to try and take Kyiv, and they were heavily devastated. Other aspects of the intelligence gathering operation within the Russian government is currently in Mariupol, in Melitopol, throughout the Donetsk, Luhansk, and other occupied parts of Ukraine, chasing down Ukrainian loyalists and partisans. And they are not in Russia trying to stop a terrorist attack by ISIS. What is left behind would obviously be the people who are not as well trusted, for one. If they're in some suburb of Moscow, it's not Russia sending its best. And really, the existence of the Russian security state is as a mafia. They're there to whoever is in charge of the local station to use them to threaten businesses and steal money and collect rents. They're not made to be competent. And as the internal Russian security structures continue to unzip, we've been saying this on the podcast over and over again, the situation in Russia continue to destabilize. Not destabilize enough to overthrow the government or something like that, but certainly enough for more of these incidents to occur. We also see this with the increase in insurgent activity in the North Caucasus. Just a few weeks ago, there was a fairly significant gun battle in Ingushetia between security forces and militants. We also know that they were incredibly arrogant about this attack. In the aftermath of that gun battle in Ingushetia, there was an alert from the U.S. State Department telling Americans who were still in Russia to stay away from public mass gatherings because it was very likely that there would soon be a terrorist attack, probably on a concert venue. When that warning was given, the response from the Russian Commentariat, from the Russian government, was to discard it entirely and even laugh at it. Like, it wasn't just a dismissal, it was a derision that the Americans would even say such a thing. Well, the Americans, but also the Canadians and the Brits, all said, terror attack, coming soon, Moscow music venue. That's three of the Five Eyes, all saying this. And Russia doesn't care. They didn't care that this was about to happen. Somewhere down the hierarchy, there may have been some intelligence officer who saw the signs and did not want to be the one to inform the bosses because then it would make them look bad. Well, common story in Russia. Yeah, you don't need to have a conspiracy here. You just needed the absence of the Russian security state, the incompetence of what was left, and the utter arrogance to ignore any warning. And really, it's not as though America's perfect on that either. After every big terrorist attack, there seems to be some news coming out of the FBI that they had been on some kind of watch list for doing wild stuff beforehand. There have been plenty of mass shootings in the United States, including from political extremists, often from political extremists. There has been extremely incompetent police responses to mass shootings in the United States, such as at Uvalde, the very famous example of there being a school shooting, and the police not seeing it worthwhile to do anything about it. These factors are not unique to Russia. They're not something wild and unexplainable. There's something that happens all over the place that is then extremely exaggerated by the particular situation that Russia is in, as I've just been explaining for who knows how many long minutes. So yeah, this is all very explainable. Don't need to get into false flag attacks. You don't have to do, the Ukrainians did it, the Americans did it, even the Russians did it. ISIS took responsibility for it. I have not seen any evidence to the contrary. But there's still some other sub-issues that this brings up. So after the suspects were arrested, the arresting officers immediately put out video of them torturing these men. Now, terror suspects are not the most sympathetic people in the world, but as I've already said, there's some doubt that these are the guys. And I'm not going to take Russia's words for it because of what I'm about to describe. So right after they were captured, the police released a video of them just wailing on these suspects, and then one of the arresting security officers taking out a knife, cutting off the ear of a suspect, and then forcing him to eat it. Later on, there were further pictures of them at the detention facility with batteries attached to their genitals. And then after they were taken into a courtroom, they were obviously just got the crap beaten out of them and had plastic bags still around their necks. This is one thing that the Russians do, is that they'll transport people with plastic bags around their heads so they can't really breathe in. Generally speaking, people who are tortured do not give good information. Nothing they say is reliable, even if they are the people who did it. And again, that's questionable because if they're being tortured, they're not giving any good testimony. None of the information that comes out of them is the slightest bit worthwhile. We've been over this in the U.S. on the torture debate regarding Guantanamo Bay and all that. Torture does not get good information. It gets the information that they will say in order to stop the torture. Basic 101 stuff. But the purpose of this is not to catch a suspect. It's because the Russian state was embarrassed. It's because the Russian security services were embarrassed, and they had to regain their dignity in the way that a Russian man knows how to regain dignity, which is through a display of brutish violence. Which explains the war in whole. It's a show of strength, not actual intelligence gathering. But what was this intelligence that was gathered? The suspects said that they had been paid money, promised money by some preacher over Telegram who told him to go shoot at these people. I'm sorry, that's complete nonsense. I don't know, I'm apologizing there, just a speech tick, I suppose. That's complete and utter nonsense. That's not how terrorism works. If it has ever happened before that a large-scale terror attack happened in, like, just outside the capital of a target country, some more planning goes into it other than some preacher told me he'd pay me money. And the money involved is $5,000, by the way. That's not due terrorism money. Even in Central Asia, where people have low salaries, $5,000 is not go do terrorism money. So the one information that Russia says they collected from these guys is, on the face of it, nothing. And beyond that, as these, you know, videos and pictures released, all these Ukrainians who themselves had been prisoners of war under the Russian security services, yep, that's pretty routine. Genital electrodes, routine. Plastic bag, routine. Beatings, stabbings, mutilations, all things the Russians just do. Although, other than Wagner, they tend not to publicize it as much as they just did. So that's kind of odd how much they decided to publicize their crimes. And this other issue here is in the aftermath. Let's just say that Central Asians do not have the easiest time. And the four suspects were Tajiks from Tajikistan. So because these four suspects were Tajiks, ever since that day, in this last week, there has been a huge upswing in hate crimes in Russia. Central Asians have long been a target of racist violence within Russia. A large number go from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan to Russia for work because the salaries are better. It's a better economy in Russia, and they tend to speak Russian because they're, you know, part of the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, Russian neo-Nazis have a habit of hunting them down on the streets every once in a while. They call it going on safari to beat up ethnic minorities or LGBT people. And with this attack, there has been a huge uptick in violence against it. There has been detentions of Tajiks, as well as some Uzbeks that I saw. There were people held up at borders. There are some people not just harassed on the streets. There are videos of Central Asian people being harassed by teenage neo-Nazis in the Moscow metro. It's looking real ugly. Now, one thing that Putin has done is he has tried to tamp down on this racial violence from time to time. That's not his version of Russian nationalism. His version of Russian nationalism sees Central Asians as a subject race, essentially, to the Russians, but one that is welcome to exist within Russia so long as they know their place. So he released some statements about how Russia has, you know, all these hundreds of ethnic groups that all are all loyal to the Russian Federation, so don't attack people. But he also mobilizes more racialized elements of Russian nationalism, so it's hard to do both at the same time there. Yeah, so large amount of ethnic hatred being displayed against Tajiks. Again, not unusual. After 9/11, ask any Muslim American or even Hindu or Sikh American if the situation was very good for them at the time either. But at the moment, because of, you know, everything I said about Russia kind of crumbling apart internally, adding in more inter-ethnic violence is a rough thing to throw into that stew. Like I said, very big topic, kind of meandered around some of the issues there. They all kind of tied into each other, so there wasn't a very obvious flow to it. Four suspects, the four people they arrested, I don't know, probably the ones who did it, but even the identities of them is a big question mark, and any information about them is not in the least bit believable. And Russia has outwardly lied about who they were working for. The Islamic State has been very active recently. Just last year, Iran had its largest terrorist attack ever by the Islamic State. ISIS has a lot of conflict with Russia. Not all the bad guys get along. Surprise, surprise. And in fact, Russia had previously really kind of built up its image as the main fighter against ISIS. So all these incredulous takes of, oh, why is ISIS fighting against Russia suddenly? Because they've never liked each other. They've been fighting for years. This isn't unusual, especially as ISIS-K, Islamic State Khorasan province, is becoming more and more active. So yeah, it's, yeah, big topic, lots of stuff. I don't expect there to be any real updates about this because the only updates that we can get will be from the Russian government and everything they say will be poisoned. So if there is something more to say later on, we'll give updates. But until then, moving forward into our final topic, the culture topic, is that the Academy Awards, the Oscars, happened in the U.S. and Ukraine won its first ever Oscar. 20 Days in Mariupol by Ukrainian film director Mstislav Chernov. One for Best Documentary. 20 Days in Mariupol, as the name suggests, talks about how he spent the first 20 days of the siege in Mariupol in the city. I have not watched it yet. I have not watched too many serious movies within the last year, to be honest. And this one in particular is especially serious, especially considering that I very narrowly missed being in Mariupol for those 20 days myself. And it's a bit of a touchy subject for myself and a lot of other people. I don't know, someday we might do, you know, a film episode or something and discuss it in more detail, but it's a rough watch and I have been avoiding it. I don't know if that makes me a coward or something. I don't know. But this is a major achievement in Ukrainian cinema. Like I said, this is the first time that a Ukrainian movie has won an Oscar. It's just unfortunate, and I'm not the only one pointing it out, that it took this horrible war for people to pay attention enough for that to happen. But we'll close out this episode, so I'll just say that if you'd like to support Ukraine more broadly, now is the time where things are very much needed. All kinds of fundraisers and such are just not receiving money, so if you can go to our link tree in the episode notes, you can find a list of places you can donate to. If you'd like to help this podcast, tell your friends, your family, share us on social media, rate us, review us, 5-star, thumbs up, etc. Those things help you with the algorithms, and who knows how algorithm works. If you'd like to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/ukrainewithouthype and join our list of supporters. I have some Patreon content in the works going right now, small things, just to kind of introduce the idea of expanded offerings over there and to join our Discord channel. So I'd now like to thank our Patreon subscribers. So thank you very much to Deborah Grazer, Randy McNerlin. The voices in my head are from Big Pharma, David Shepard, Giorgio, Ivana Kokratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Dennis Napalm, Devi, Dimitri Litvin, Etienne, James Berg, Jan, Inara, Jenny Louise, Kevin Albritton, Marguerite, Michael Wickman, Mike Barone, PLM, Shieldwall, Silas Frank, T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Francois, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jared Bailey, Jared, Julia Lindsay, Laura De Leon, Levy Grove, Marianne Obbs, Matt Miller, Melissa Koselko, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, RDK, Sanjay, Scott Perry, Scott Gangris, Scott Tokayuk, Steve Akers, Subtle Knife, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, Victoria Leontineva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all very much. You're what keep this podcast going. So until next week, Slava Ukraini.